About 2 years later, what was his first march on Jerusalem. And that's when he took Jehoiachin out of being the king of Judah and took him captive and replaced him with Zedekiah. And he had also taken, I think it was 10,000 or perhaps only 1,000. I don't remember offhand, and I probably should, captives out of the chief men of Judah. He had taken hostage and had brought them back to Babylon and employed them there. They were hostages to ensure that the people of Judah would stay loyal to him. Well, it didn't make that assurance. I mean, it didn't do that. It didn't have that desired effect. But Jehoiakim was 25 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Zebudah, the daughter of Pedaiah, the daughter of Rumah, or the daughter of Pedaiah of Rumah, I'm sorry. And he did that which was evil in the sight of Yahweh, according to all his fathers had done. Then the first verse of 2 Kings chapter 24, verse 1, and that was the end of chapter 23. In his days, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up, and Jehoiakim became his servant 3 years. So that's when Nebuchadnezzar first took the throne. He then turned and rebelled against him. And when that happened, Nebuchadnezzar had taken many captives of Judah hostage, and Jehoiachin rebelled a short time later. Jehoiachin wasn't even the king for a year, and Nebuchadnezzar came and he took Jehoiachin hostage, and he took 10,000 captives. It says later on in 2 Kings 24, and he carried away all Jerusalem and all the princes and all the mighty men of valor, even 10,000 captives. So he made one voyage or march to Jerusalem, and he put them into subjection in Jehoiakim's time. And then Jehoiachin succeeded Jehoiakim, his father, and Jehoiachin rebelled in a very short time. And the book of Nezar came in, I think it was 9 months, and took Jehoiachin captive and took 10,000 of the chief men of the princes of Judah, and all the princes and the mighty men of valor, even 10,000 captives, and all the craftsmen and smiths. None remained except the poorest sort of the people of the land. So he took 10,000 captives from Jerusalem. Of course, there were a lot of other people in Judah at that time. And where it says the people of the land, it's probably speaking about only the people of Jerusalem and not all of Judah, because the number is only 10,000. Later on, the Babylonians would take a much larger number from Jerusalem into captivity. So Jehoiachin went off to be a prisoner in the palace, in the Nebuchadnezzar's palace in Babylon, or the capital city, at least. And Zedekiah became the king. He was the last king. So here we see in Ezekiel that his ministry begins in the fifth year of Jehoiachin's captivity. So if Jehoiachin was, with all certainty, taken captive sometime around, and I'm going to get the date straight, so I'm going to look in my notes. If he was taken captive in 598 BC, then this year, in the fifth year, must be 593 BC. And that's when the ministry of Ezekiel begins. So where it says the 30th year, 593 BC was the 30th year of nothing. There is no real marker in the history of Judah that goes back 30 years from 593 BC. That would be 623 BC. And Joash is the king, and he's going to be the king for another 15 years. And Assyria is the empire, and Assyria would be the empire from 623 for another 11 years. 623 BC, there's nothing that marks that as a date that Ezekiel would be counting, but I would have to make the assumption that here, where Ezekiel says in the 30th year, I think he's talking about his own 30th year, that he's 30 years old right now. And that's my opinion. And Ezekiel was apparently a priest. He was apparently of the tribe of Levi. So the priests, since they usually started their ministries or their work for the community in their 30th year, that's when Ezekiel is counting. He's counting his own 30th year here. And it's the fifth year of Jehoiachin's captivity, meaning it's also the fifth year of Zedekiah being the king. Zedekiah was the king until the destruction of Jerusalem in 586. So Zedekiah starts his ministry about 6 or 7 years before the destruction of Jerusalem. And that's the scenario we have. At one time, I had thought that the reference to the river Kabar was the river Habor, and it was further north, and perhaps Ezekiel was in the Assyrian captivity, but he wasn't. He must have been in the captivity of the time of Jehoiachin. He must have been among the 10,000 that were taken captive by Nebuchadnezzar. And Daniel the prophet and his companions were also among that same 10,000. They went into captivity at the same time. It seems to me that Daniel may have actually been a little younger than Ezekiel. Daniel may have been 5 to 10 years younger than Ezekiel. And that's just from that's just deduced from the descriptions of Daniel of himself in the book of Daniel. It's an opinion, but I really can't prove it. That's all I wanted to preface this with, basically.
Yep. Lost that.
No, so it's 593, and Ezekiel's 30 years old, and he's about to start his ministry.
Microphone activated.
Don't the Jews have some like stupid myth that this river is like a ditch or something?
No, I think this river is, it might be more of a canal. And you know, a Jew that never lifted a shovel in his life might refer to a canal as a ditch. But it had in my opinion, it had to also be a natural river or stream or brook in part. And this also basically, and I've mentioned this in commentaries, this reflects the tradition that when there was no legitimate temple or synagogue building, that the captives, that the Judeans abroad, when there was no legitimate temple or synagogue building, Judeans in sojourning in other lands would gather at rivers and hold their Sabbath celebrations and activities at a river. Muted. And we see that in the account of Paul and Lydia in the book of Acts in the New Testament, when there was no synagogue in the town, in Philippi, I believe it was, that Lydia and her companions, her female companions, had gathered by a river to pray. And that's where Paul and Titus, I think, was with him, had encountered her. That's in Acts chapter 16. Lydia was from Thyatira. But Paul had crossed to Neapolis and then to Philippi in verse 12, Acts 16, verse 12, the chief city of that part of Macedonia and the colony. And we were in that city abiding certain days and went on a Sabbath. We went out of the city by a river where prayer was wont to be made. Well, we see how old that tradition is here in Ezekiel. You know, these 10,000 Dayans are only in captivity in Babylon for about 5 years. It's very, very, very likely that they have no synagogue or gathering place of their own. They're in captivity living among the Babylonians. So they gather by a river on a Sabbath. Same thing we see here in Acts chapter 16. And that makes it evident to me that in the time of John the Baptist, that's why he found so many converts by the river. Because there must have been a lot of people at that time who were estranged from the temple in Jerusalem and from the Levites of the time that instead went to the river for their Sabbath day activities.
It must have been really common. You mentioned that Daniel is a contemporary of Ezekiel, and I remember in Daniel chapter 9, he's also praying by the river.
Well, yeah. Yes, that's very plausible. I didn't remember that specifically, but...
Oh, I thought it was. Okay, I'm wrong.
It's in chapter 8. It's in Daniel chapter 8, and it's in chapter 10, and it's in Daniel chapter 12. So Daniel is regularly by the river. So that's a good observation.
Yeah, I messed up my numbers. Sorry.
That's okay. I mess them up all the time. I don't know the Bible.
Me neither.
I don't know about the numbers anyway. Okay, Eamon, I'm sorry about the long preface, but it's probably a good thing that we did it.
Yeah, that was good. Now it came to pass in the 30th year, in the fourth month, in the fifth day of the month, as I was among the captives by the river of Kabar, that the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God. In the fifth day of the month, which was the fifth year of King Jehoiakim's captivity, the word of Yahweh came expressly unto Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzu, in the land of the Chaldeans by the river of Kabar, and the hand of Yahweh was there upon him. And I looked, and behold, a whirlwind came out of the north, a great cloud, and a fire enfolding itself, and a brightness was about it. And out of the midst thereof as a colour of amber, out of the midst of the fire. Also out of the midst thereof came the likeness of four living creatures, and this was their appearance. They had the likeness of a man. And every one had four faces, and every one had four wings. And their feet were straight feet, and the sole of their feet was like the sole of a calf's foot, and they sparkled like the colour of burnished brass. And they had the hands of a man under their wings on their four sides. And they four had their faces and their wings. Their wings were joined one to another. They turned not when they went. They went every one straight forward. As to the likeness of their faces, they four had the face of a man and the face of a lion on the right side. And they had four had the face of an ox on the left side. They four also had the face of an eagle. Thus were their faces, and their wings were stretched upward. Two wings of every one were joined one to another, and two covered their bodies. And they went every one straight forward. Whither the spirit was to go, they went, and they turned not when they went. As to the likeness of the living creatures, their appearance was like burning coals of fire, and like the appearance of lamps, it went up and down among the living creatures. And the fire was bright, and out of the fire went forth lightning. And the living creatures ran and returned as the appearance of a flash of lightning. Now as I beheld the living creatures, behold one wheel upon the earth by the living creatures, with his four faces. The appearance of the wheels and their work was like unto the colour of a beryl, and they four had one likeness, and their appearance and their work was, as it were, a wheel in the middle of a wheel. When they went up on their four sides, and they turned not when they went. As for their wings, they were so high that they were dreadful, and their wings were full of eyes round about them four. And when the living creatures went, the wheels went by them. And when the living creatures were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up. that a good spot to stop?
Yeah, you know, and I wouldn't, a lot of people think, oh, this is some kind of UFO, and they try to make depictions of unidentified flying objects, exploit them, and I think all that is just crazy. And I think it's basically idolatry to harp on this too much and imagine what Ezekiel was describing. It really doesn't matter. It's a representation of the throne of God. And the more important aspect is the symbols it contains, because they're very much like the symbol of the throne of God in a Revelation, where we read from chapter 4, verse 5, and it says, "And going out from the throne, stars and voices and thunders and seven lamps of fire burning before the throne, which are the seven spirits of Yahweh, and before the throne as a sea of glass like crystal, and in the midst of the throne and around the throne, four living creatures full of eyes in front and behind. And the first living creature like a lion, and the second living creature like a young bull," which we have an ox here in the translation of the King James, but they're really the same. "And the third living creature having a face as a man, and the fourth living creature like a flying eagle. And the four living creatures, each one of them having six wings above, full of eyes all around and within, and they do not have rest day and night, saying, Holy, 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 Prince Yahweh Almighty, who was and who is and who is coming." So that being said, we see so many similarities here with Ezekiel's vision, but we also see a few differences that we probably shouldn't even harp on or dwell on. The symbols themselves are often said, and I agree, but of course it can't really be proven. It can only be halfway proven or maybe subjectively three quarters of the way, but the four symbols represent the four chief of the tribes of Israel around the encampment, and they are Judah and Reuben and Joseph and Dan, and they're represented in that order: Judah by the lion, Reuben by the man, Joseph by the bull, and Dan by the eagle. Now, that was a common old school Christian identity interpretation and British Israel interpretation. And I can believe that, and I agree with it to a point, but it can't really be deduced from scripture itself. You can't really tell that the eagle was the insignia of the tribe of Dan, and you can't really tell that the symbol of the man was the insignia of the tribe of Reuben. But in scripture, in several places, both the lion, of course, and the bull are associated with the tribes of Judah and Joseph, or Ephraim especially. They are also the creatures of which what we call a cherub is a composite. And a cherub looks a lot more like, it looks a lot like an Egyptian sphinx, but the sphinx only incorporates two or three of those creatures: the body of the lion, the head of the man. I'm not sure if the Sphinx had the hooves of a bull or not, but the Assyrian cherub does very often incorporate three of those creatures, and sometimes the wings as well. And it's called a cherub, just like the cherub that we know from our English pronunciation of the Hebrew word. The Assyrians called it a cherub in their inscriptions, and it was a man's head with wings and the body of a bull, and sometimes it had the forefront of a lion and the hind end of a bull. And there were different variations on it in archaeology found in diverse places, but the typical cherubs, the typical ancient Hebrew and Mesopotamian cherubs, were drawn in that manner, almost like a sphinx, and they incorporated portions of all, or at least some of those four animals.
when the Assyrians sculpted a carib, what were they trying to represent? What was it symbolizing?
Yeah, you know, I really don't remember very well the elements of the pagan religion, but the cherub symbolized the spirits that guarded the palace or the whatever edifice that they were carved onto or placed by the gates.
And what would it represent with Hebrews?
Well, with the Hebrews, I think it does represent the 12 tribes of Israel, the principal tribes of the 12 tribes of Israel. So it basically represents the children of Israel, and the mercy seat of God was atop of the Ark of the Covenant in between a pair of cherubs. I relate them to the cherubs that were described as having been placed at the path to the Garden of Eden to keep the way to the Tree of Life. That doesn't mean to prevent man from getting to the Tree of Life, as the denominational churches claim. That portrays the fact that the way to the Tree of Life was going to be kept open to man, that he would attain it, not that he would be prevented from it. And of course, the Tree of Life, where the cherubs later appear atop the Ark of the Covenant, that's where the law is kept. So we can see that the law is the path to the Tree of Life.
And when we see the cherubs on the Ark, it sort of represents Yahweh's favor with Israel. And then I suppose when we see the four living creatures in the Revelation, it's sort of a signal that he still has favor with this people and with them only.
Absolutely. That's
very cool.
The very purpose of all that symbolism here and in Revelation and in Genesis and in the construction of the Ark of the Covenant, those same symbols reflect the fact that Yahweh has the same purpose, that it never changes.
Yeah, like we have 20 chapters in Exodus just about the design of the tabernacle, not the tabernacle, of the ark. And it's there for a reason. Like Yahweh gave those specific details to Moses and those carpenters for a reason.
Yes, I agree. Even if we don't understand the entire reason yet, I agree. I never read too much into the numbers. I really don't. Some people do. That there was a gentleman here at this Wednesday night Bible study back in 2010, 2011, 2012. It lasted about that long. The original purpose for doing this Wednesday night Bible study was a group in Louisiana that invited me after I got home from prison in 2009. And in 2010 or 11, I convinced them to move into TeamSpeak here so that other people could participate. And they did. And I don't think any of the people here regularly now were there regularly at that time. Maybe Martin. Jerry was kind of early, but I don't remember how early. And the rest of y'all that typically come here are a lot more recent. But that's okay. That's life, because the people in that Bible study all went their own way when they had internal disagreements and a falling out. But they were people familiar with my Facebook accounts might know Don Brown and Gerald Mosley. And they were the primary participants in that Bible study, because it was at one or the other of their homes. Randy Aiken was another one, and Randy knew his Bible inside and out, and we got along great. Unfortunately, Randy died of a sudden heart attack, and his truck ran off the road, and he passed about 4 years ago, 5 years ago. But he was a great guy, and we used to tease each other all the time, because he was really into the numerology, and I was never really into it. I don't want to look for symbolism in numbers. I would much rather read the plain word and understand it, because I believe God speaks to us primarily in the plain word. Well, Randy knew every single number in that tabernacle memorized and in the temple He could tell you how many steps here, cubits between there and the other side, tell you all those details.
Wow.
He really into that big. And then he had his own ideas about what the numbers mean. But I think a lot of them may have been drawn from sources like Bullinger. And I never got into that because the Kabbalists and the Talmudic Jews are really into that big time. I
mean, yeah.
Numerology and really twist everything into pretzels. So I don't get into the whole numerology thing, significance to a lot of those numbers at least, but at the appropriate time, I believe Yahweh himself will make us known to us what that significance is, because men have twisted that into idolatry and all kinds of ridiculous ideas since the dawn of time. They've twisted numerology.
Yeah, it's definitely dangerous. It's really cool that he memorized all that, though.
Oh, yeah, he knew just about all of it. He could tell you how many little acorns were on the design of the Persian stuff. I don't know if I should call them acorns. I don't remember the name in Exodus for them. But, yeah, he could tell you just about everything.
So we continue?
So we tease each other about that all the time. I tease him about his love for the numbers, and he teased me about my thing for them, basically.
You know, as long as we're not disagreeing over, like, really major things, and I think it's nice to jest with each other and have patience.
Yeah, I mean, it was always an amicable relationship. I miss Randy. He drove a 25-year-old Ford, wouldn't have anything else.
Don't need to buy a new car every year.
He wouldn't have anything else.
Well, he's not really dead.
Oh. No, I'm sure he's not. Okay, Eamon.
Whithersoever the spirit was to go, they went. Thither was their spirit to go, and the wheels were lifted up over against them, for the spirit of the living creature was in the wheels. When those went, these went, and when those stood, these stood. And when those were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up over against them, for the spirit of the living creature was in their wheels. And the likeness of the firmament upon their heads of the living creature was as the color of the terrible crystal stretched forth over their heads above. And under the firmament were their wings straight, the one toward the other. Every one had two, which covered on this side, and every one had two, which covered on that side, their bodies. And when they went, I heard the noise of their wings, like the noise of great waters, as the voice of the Almighty, the voice of speech, as the noise of an host. When they stood, they let down their wings. And there was a voice from the firmament that was over their heads, when they stood and had let down their wings. And above the firmament that was over their heads was the likeness of a throne, as the appearance of a sapphire stone. And upon the likeness of the throne was the likeness as the appearance of a man above upon it. And I saw as a colour of amber, as the appearance of fire round about within it, from the appearance of his loins even upward, and from the appearance of his loins even downward, I saw as it were the appearance of fire, and it had brightness round about, as the appearance of the bow that is in the cloud in the day of rain, so was the appearance of the brightness round about. This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of Yahweh. And when I saw it, I fell upon my face, and I heard a voice of one that spake.
Ezekiel's seeing a vision. He's not necessarily seeing anything that actually exists. So I would conjecture that the likeness of the throne was the likeness as the appearance of a man above upon it, that he was seeing a vision of Christ, but he wasn't actually seeing Christ himself. And that the appearance, it isn't really in detail here, but it's at least evokes the visions of the Ancient of Days and Revelation chapter 1. Where in the very beginning of this segment, in verse 24, I think it was, no, in verse 20, and it starts to say, and when those went, these went, and when those stood, these stood. I think it's opposing that these and those are the wheels that had eyes all around, as compared to the wheels, the rings with eyes all around, as compared to the wheels with the four living creatures in them. And we see a similar description in Revelation chapter 4, where each one of the living creatures had six wings above, full of eyes all around and within, right? So it's not the same exact description, but it's very similar in many ways, and they're both describing, very clearly describing, the same entity or saw very similar entities, at least, which represented the same thing, which is the throne of God. And I do believe what's more important is the symbolism of what that throne represents, that he's the king of Israel and he's the God of Israel, and the four living creatures represent the children of Israel, which were summed up in the tabernacle of the wilderness and the standards of the four principal tribes and the visions of the cherub and the use of the cherub, as we've discussed. That's more important. That's the most important thing to recognize here, in my opinion. Rather than imagine spaceships and Eric von Däniken and Zechariah Sitchin. Fantasies. I'm sorry.
Looks strong too, yeah.
A lot of people are drawn to those things, but that they, those same people usually don't care too much about the plain message of Scripture. They're always looking for something fascinating or intriguing or mysterious, thinking they could figure it out.
Usually the fascinating stuff they come up with is the most sci-fi garbage you can imagine, though.
Well, right, that's true. I think it's a form of idolatry in itself.
Yeah, I would agree. Because they become so fixed on it, right? They don't care about anything else.
Right. Okay, that's about all I have to say about chapter one, unless somebody has questions or somebody else has some input. The rainbow there is reminiscent of Genesis 9, and I'm sure it's supposed to evoke that, the promises to Noah.
I wonder if they were all being gay in Noah's time, too.
Yeah. Something tells me no. That's straight blasphemy. But for our modern society to adopt that rainbow as some kind of symbol for one world inclusionism, let me call it that, which is basically the Tower of Babel story all over again.
Now, you can't define something which God has already defined for us.
Well, they try hard to abrogate it all for themselves, the world's devils and perverts. If all y'all lose me, it's because it's storming very bad here. It's thundering right now, and the rain hasn't started again yet. We already had one band of it, but we have a tornado warning until 2 a.m. right now. And I'm expecting bad storms to start at any minute. So if I disappear, I mean, I got generators and stuff, but if I disappear, y'all know why. They're not automated. I got to go hook them up by hand. I don't have the money for automatic generators. I'm sorry. Shit's expensive. Hey, man, we could do chapter 2 is a short one.
Yes. And he said unto me, Son of man, stand upon thy feet, and I will speak unto thee. And the Spirit entered into me when he spake unto me, and set me upon my feet, that I heard him that spake unto me. And he said unto me, Son of man, I send thee to the children of Israel, to a rebellious nation that hath rebelled against me. They and their fathers have transgressed against me, even unto this very day. For they are impudent children and stiff-hearted. I do send thee unto them, and thou shalt say unto them, Thus saith Yahweh God. And they, whether they will hear or whether they will forbear, for they are a rebellious house, yet shall know that there hath been a prophet among them. And thou, son of man, be not afraid of them, neither be afraid of their words, though briers and thorns be with thee, and thou dost dwell among scorpions. Be not afraid of their words, nor be dismayed at their looks, though they be a rebellious house. And thou shalt speak my words unto them, whether they will hear or whether they will forbear, for they are most rebellious. But thou, son of man, hear what I say unto thee. Be not thou rebellious like that rebellious house. Open thy mouth and eat that I give thee. And when I looked, behold, an hand was sent unto me, and lo, a roll of a book was therein. And he spread it before me, and it was written within and without. And there was written therein lamentations and mourning and woe.
This happens a few times in the Revelation too, that when John was confronted by an angel in his visions, that he pictured himself or envisioned himself as falling on his face or kneeling to worship the angel. And the angel told John basically to get up and stop that, because that's not the way it's supposed to be, that the angel is just one of his own brethren and he should only worship God. Here, that this likeness, which Ezekiel believes is the glory of Yahweh, and we shouldn't dispute that, also told him, just get up and stand up and I'll talk to you. So ancient kings would expect you to kneel or to prostrate yourself when they address you. And we see that a lot in the Old Testament of the pharaohs of Egypt. And it's also inscriptions a lot, also very frequently. Well, this seems to indicate to me that our God is a humble God, and his messengers are also humble. And they don't want to be worshipped. God wants to be obeyed. He doesn't really want to be worshipped like you're a dog and you have to lay down on the ground before him, like the ancient pharaohs had expected. He just wants you to stand there like a man and obey him. That there's a big difference in the mentality there, as far as I'm concerned. Obedience is much more important than the show of prostrating oneself.
That's an amazing insight, and it reminds me how Christ would rebuke the Pharisees for trying to be righteous through show.
Right. Right.
Microphone activated.
That's an amazing insight. I know that verse 6 is talking about the house of Israel and Judah, but I really like the verse. I really like it because, you know, briars and thorns dwell with you, and it reminds me of Christ saying, you know, do you gather grapes from thorns and figs from thistles, and then scorpions even, which reminds me of Christ saying to the apostles that he gave them authority to tread over scorpions. I wish we could like cite this verse to show people like, hey, those thorns and those thistles and those scorpions are like Canaanites and stuff. But I guess this verse here is talking about Israel.
Well, you know what? I think it is talking about the house of Israel, but
see you soon. Welcome back.
It's likening them to the other races or the Canaanites, if you will, the other tribes, because they're disobedient. And when an Adamic man and even a child of Israel is disobedient in the flesh, he's no better than a Canaanite.
Right.
So you're right. I wouldn't cite this in relation to those New Testament passages, but and there are many other verses to cite in relation to those passages, but this is tempting. But what this demonstrates is that when the children of Israel are disobedient and refuse their God, that they're no better than these beasts.
Sort of like thorns. Right. Sort of like how Paul writes in Ephesians that you were one time sons of disobedience, I think he says, were. Right.
Yeah, right. Like the others. That's what he said, like the others.
Right. So that would be the verse to cross-reference here to Ezekiel 2:6, I think.
Yes, I believe so. I believe you're right. I would agree with that. That's a very good exposition. And this is speaking of all Israel, and much of Ezekiel is for all Israel, just like much of Jeremiah was for all of Israel. But some of Jeremiah was only applicable to Judah, which had to do with the future and the destruction of Jerusalem. And Ezekiel is very much the same.
All right. It's interesting that the scroll has the same taste for Ezekiel and John, but only John mentions that it was bitter in his stomach. Unless maybe Isaiah said that too. I know Isaiah had to eat it.
Right. He doesn't... Well, he does in the next chapter. But he doesn't say it was bitter in his belly. That's true. That's in Revelation chapter 10.
You know, all this stuff about eating the scroll and how the scroll represents, like, the word of God. It reminds me of how Christ is the Word made flesh. And in John, he's like, eat me.
Right. It's all the eating of the scroll has to do with the consuming of the word, I'm sure. I don't see a reference in Isaiah to eating a scroll, though.
Well, doesn't he do it when he sees the seraphim?
I'm trying to look for it. I don't really remember it explicitly.
I mean, you know the Bible much better than I do. I might be wrong.
Well, he doesn't really, he eats a coal, not really the scroll.
Oh, okay.
The coal.
Right.
And one of the seraphims under me having a live coal in his hand, which he had taken with the tongs from off the altar. So it's coal. I mean, it's the same idea, right?
Yeah.
But it's not the same allegory. I don't think this allegory exists anywhere else in Revelation.
So nobody else eats a scroll other than John and Ezekiel?
Not that I remember, no sir. I mean, I could always be wrong, but not that I remember. It's not something people do every day to eat a book.
Well, now they have all these fancy books with scented pages. Maybe it's a bit more flavorful. I don't know.
The word scroll actually only appears twice in Scripture, in Revelation 6:14 and Isaiah 34:4. And that's not even referring to a book. It's the heavens shall be rolled together as a scroll, which is like, not really referring to a literal scroll. Scrolls doesn't appear at all. I'm going to go with book now. Book appears very often, and it really should have been translated as scroll, at least on most of those occasions, depending on what Greek word represents the Greek. But I don't know if the Greek manner of making actual books out of vellum and cut into uniform sheets and sewed together at one end, they were the original books, and the Greeks made them at a very early time. I don't know that Hebrews ever made books like that. I mean, we don't have enough information to determine that. We really don't. The word sifra is the word that we get the English word cipher from, and it's a book, a document, a scroll that could, it's just a general term, right?
You know, if all these prophecies were written in books, maybe we wouldn't have these chronology issues today. They got all the scrolls messed up.
Yeah, right. That they wouldn't have been dropped so easy. That's true. Yeah, because as we'll see, the chronology and Ezekiel also has some problems. Roll. That's the word I didn't look up. Roll is in there actually a lot more than I thought.
Maybe it's a verb sometimes though, right?
Yeah, it may be a verb. It's a verb in Mark 16, so it actually appears in 25 verses of the Old Testament. And sometimes it is a verb. Roll a stone, roll a stone. It's a roll in Ezra. It's a great roll in Isaiah chapter 8, but Isaiah is not told to eat it. Sorry. It's a roll in Jeremiah. Only in chapter 36, about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 times, the word roll appears in Jeremiah chapter 36. And it's always a roll in a book. which he was told to read and then to burn. And I believe it may have been you, Noble, that raised the question as to how we have it if Jeremiah burned it. Because it says it's a roll. But in verse 28, it says, take thee again another roll and write in all the former words that were in the first roll, which the king had burned. Okay. Yeah, sometimes it's a verb. It's a verb in Jeremiah chapter 51. Rolls fly, though, in Zechariah chapter 5. Flying scroll. Flying roll. So that's pretty...
Oh, yeah, I remember that, yeah. There's a lot of crazy imagery in Zechariah.
Yes, there is. Okay, we roll with Ezekiel chapter 3 if y'all want.
Good one.
A little longer.
Moreover, he said unto me, Son of man, eat that thou findest. Eat this roll, and go speak unto the house of Israel. So I opened my mouth, and he caused me to eat that roll. And he said unto me, Son of man, cause thy belly to eat, and fill thy bowels with the roll, with this roll that I give thee. Then did I eat it, and it was in my mouth as honey for sweetness. And he said unto me, Son of man, go, get thee unto the house of Israel, and speak with my words unto them. But thou art not sent to a people of a strange speech and of an hard language, but to the house of Israel. Not to many people of a strange speech and of an hard language, which words thou canst not understand. Surely, had I sent thee to them, they would have hearkened unto thee. But the house of Israel would not hearken unto thee, for they will not hearken unto me. For all the house of Israel are impudent and hard-hearted. Behold, I have made thy face strong against their faces, and thy forehead strong against their foreheads. As an adamant harder than flint have I made thy forehead. Fear them not, neither be dismayed at their looks, though they may be a rebellious house. Moreover, he said unto me, Son of man, all my words that I shall speak unto thee, receive in thine heart, and hear with thine ears. And go, get thee to them of the captivity, unto the children of thy people, and speak unto them, and tell them, Thus saith Yahweh God, whether they will hear, or whether they will forbear.
That word, adamant, is interesting. It's actually better as in English, it's better as an adjective. It's something that's inconquerable. But here it's actually used from a noun. And according to this, I want to see the Hebrew word real quick, if y'all want to entertain my curiosity.
As an adamant harder than flint. Yeah. I have no idea. Is it a rock, maybe?
In Brown Driver Briggs, it means thorns or thorn bushes.
Oh.
But also, as a secondary definition, adamant as sharp. Figuratively, in Ezekiel, of the prophet's firmness, or in other passages in Ecclesiastes or in Zechariah, part of heart. But adamant in English means basically unyielding or hardened or something that can't be conquered. It's actually a Greek word, adamus, which means inconquerable. And I'm going to actually get my little, my paper Liddell and Scott out to verify that, but I'm sure that's what it means. I mean, unless my memory is that damn bad, but I did turn 62 the other day. I'm almost there. Wow, there are a lot more Adamus, A-D-A-M-A-S. It's a negation of a verb, damazo. Adamus means untamed or unconquerable. Damazo meaning to conquer, right? So it means without conquering, with something that can't be conquered. Adamus, A-D-A-M-A-S in Greek. And it's that from which we get our English adjective adamant from. But the primary meaning of this word has to do with something sharp like thorns or thorn bushes or a sharp stone or a flint.
Maybe it's like a pun, because when I'm reading this chapter, I sort of feel like Yahweh is telling Ezekiel that his forehead will be stronger than their foreheads. And that makes me think of like intellectual debate. If they're like, hey, who are you? You don't know the scriptures. Where are you coming from? Sort of thing. So like sharp, maybe it's like he's smart or something. I don't know. Maybe it's like a really deep pun Yahweh is making in the like ahead of time. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good observation, because the word for harder is actually chazak, which is defined as in Strong's as strong, stout, and then secondarily as severe or sharp or hard. But severe or sharp, a thorn sharper. I have, as a thorn sharper than flint, have I made your forehead, is how I would probably translate that if I was translating Ezekiel.
So they're not going to be able to stump Ezekiel, I guess, is what Yahweh is saying.
Well, right, because his word, he being a prophet of Yahweh, his word is going to condemn them, right? And they're not going to be able to get around the word that Yahweh gives to Ezekiel. They're not going to be able to get around it. And that's represented in that scroll that he ate, right? That they're not going to get around what Yahweh has him speak.
And I think it's important that Yahweh gives Ezekiel this encouragement, because if I remember correctly, he's also about to give Ezekiel a very stern warning if he doesn't follow his obligations.
Well, right. And then he's going to give him a very arduous task.
That too, yeah. Yeah, we talked about that on the forum call, having to lie on your side for how many months?
Over a year.
Yeah, that's hell.
Well over a year. Yeah, it's well over a year. It's crazy. It's like, wow, really, God? You really want me to do this? Are you sure? Did I dial the right number?
Right. Well, maybe Yahweh would be like, go and complain to your brethren then. Like the cause
of this. Yeah, I mean, you can't be a bitch when God calls you to do something is the bottom line there.
Oh, yeah.
That's less.
Especially if you have the fear of God in your heart.
Right. Ezekiel didn't whine. He only complained that he wouldn't cook his food with human dung.
Is that explicitly mentioned in the law as being unclean?
No, I don't think so. I really don't think so.
I guess that's impossible, right? Because Yahweh wouldn't tell Ezekiel to sin. So
how could we possibly go to the bathroom if dung was unclean?
Right, yeah. So it's like a cultural common sense thing. That's why Ezekiel was disputing, not because of a law.
That's my opinion, and the word dung doesn't even appear in the book of Deuteronomy. It does appear three times in Leviticus, but not in a sense where it's unclean. It only appears in contexts where a bullock and his hide and his flesh and his dung he burnt with fire without the camp, outside the camp, right? So there's statements like that, but the dung is just another part of the carcass, right? Along with the skin and the flesh, and the dung was just another portion of the carcass that would normally be discarded, right? So it appears once in Exodus in the same exact context. But the flesh of the bullock and his skin and his dung thou shalt burn with fire without the camp. It is a sin offering, or outside camp, because it's a sin offering. And the same thing in Numbers. So in five contexts in the book of five verses in the book of Moses where the word dung appears, it's always in that context, the same context, that it just gets burnt outside the camp with the rest of the sin offering, right? So there's nothing in the law about dung being unclean, but yeah, I think it just is a cultural no-no, right? That even though it's not in the law of God, that we typically don't eat our food with human dung.
Yeah, we're not niggers.
Yeah, I could understand that. I would think that was repulsive too.
This is the ultimate proof that the Israelites were white.
Yeah, I'm sure. Niggers would use human dung to cook their mosquito pancakes on a fire. I don't even know how well dung burns. I mean, I never tried to burn it or to use it as fuel. I gather dry dung might have some uses, fuel.
Was using like cow dung and stuff a common practice at the time, or in Ezekiel's time?
Well, Ezekiel chose to use animal dung in place of the... I think Yahweh actually told him, okay, I get it, use animal dung and that's okay. I think that's how it went. It's Ezekiel chapter 4, I think, so we're going to encounter it. By next week.
Yeah, it's too bad the tailors weren't here tonight, because on farms, they actually have a pit where they put all the animal dung, and they put a cover over it, a tarp, and it's called a digester, and they use the methane gas that comes off of it for fuel.
Okay, I mean, I know dung... I know that dung produces methane gas. I just didn't know if it did that in its own decomposition or if it just did it because it's dung, right? So it would be the methane gas in the dung that would be the element that's most likely to make it burn, I think. I don't know if that's right. I'm not a chemist.
The Indians, they have like these 55-gallon drums outside of their houses that they put all their crap in. And then they use the fumes coming off of it for the flames on their stoves.
Okay. And it makes sense, but I wouldn't want to use human dung. I agree with Ezekiel.
Hope that's not part of the Green New Deal, the new natural gas.
I'm sorry, Herbert, she came over very loud and I really couldn't make out that well.
I said, I hope that's not part of the Green New Deal, the new natural gas.
I bet the Jews would hate it because the methane would cause climate change.
Yeah, of course. That's why they just want us to eat insects. Well, that's how they're tricking us into eating insects. Some people are actually going for that. Save the world, roaches. Yeah, delicious. Sick bastards.
You know, if I'm ever forced against my will to eat crickets and grasshoppers, at least I know it's clean. I won't like it. I'll hate every second of it, but at least I know it's clean.
Crickets make really good brim bait, from what all the locals tell me. I don't know. I haven't really caught any brim yet. I put a whole lot of time into it. When it comes down to being no food in the stores, I got a shovel and a fishing pole and I can find worms, right?
Will I continue?
Yeah, I just want to note that here in verse 11, did you make it to 11? Maybe you didn't make it that far.
Yeah, I did, yeah.
Okay, in verse 11, Ezekiel's told to go to them of the captivity under the children of thy people. Yeah, you know, the people in the Assyrian captivity, by the time Ezekiel was taken captive, the people in the Assyrian captivity are probably, most of them are not reachable. Because the Scythians and the Cimmerians had been far out, most of them at least, had been far out of reach by this time. Yahweh's talking about that 10,000 that Ezekiel was taken captive along with to go to them and say these words to them. I'm not saying these words aren't for the rest of Israel. They certainly are, but it might be centuries and centuries before the rest of Israel ever hears them or sees them in Bibles. Okay, then that's all I have to say about that.
Then the Spirit took me up, and I heard behind me a voice of a great rushing, saying, "Blessed be the glory of Yahweh from his place." I heard also that noise of the wings of the living creatures that touched one another, and the noise of the wheels over against them, and the noise of a great rushing. So the Spirit lifted me up and took me away, and I went into bitterness in the heat of my spirit, but the hand of Yahweh was strong upon me. Then I came to them of the captivity at Tel Aviv, that dwelt by the river of Kabar, and I sat where they sat, and remained there astonished among them 7 days. And it came to pass at the end of 7 days that the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, "Son of man, I have made thee a watchman unto the house of Israel. Therefore hear the word at my mouth, and give them warning from me. When I say unto the wicked, thou shalt surely die, and thou givest him not warning, nor speakest to warn the wicked from his wicked way, to save his life, the same wicked man shall die in his iniquity, but his blood will I require at thine hand. Yet if thou warn the wicked, and he turn not from his wickedness, nor from his wicked way, he shall die in his iniquity. But thou hast delivered thy soul. Again, when a righteous man doth turn from his righteousness and commit iniquity, and I lay a stumbling block before him, he shall die, because thou hast not given him warning. He shall die in his sin, and his righteousness which he hath done shall not be remembered, but his blood will I require at thine hand. Nevertheless, if thou warn the righteous man, the righteous sin not, and he doth not sin, he shall surely live, because he is warned. Also thou hast delivered thy soul. And the hand of Yahweh was there upon me, and he said unto me, Arise, go forth into the plain, and I will there talk with thee.
Well, these people that are in the captivity in Babylon, these 10,000, are really being warned very strongly that they better keep the law. And I really believe that this applies to them above anyone else, because Yahweh had promised that Jerusalem would only be desolate for 70 years, and then there would be people who would return to Jerusalem. That was already prophesied in Jeremiah. Jeremiah began his prophesying several years, actually probably about 20 years before Ezekiel. So even though they were contemporaries, Ezekiel's ministry was only about half the length of Jeremiah's. Ezekiel's ministry corresponds to the second half of Jeremiah's. And it's evident that, I mean, I'm not saying they didn't know each other at all. They probably did see each other. They were both in Jerusalem, but Ezekiel was taken out of Jerusalem at some time, and Jeremiah remained. So during the course of Ezekiel's ministry, they probably never knew each other.
I hate to ask this question. Tel Aviv, that sounds very phonetically similar to the modern day Canaanite.
Yes.
Hellhole Tel Aviv. Is that the same place?
I was already there. I was already going to discuss that. I just didn't get a chance.
Oh, okay.
Tel Aviv is phonetically the same as the modern Tel Aviv, right? Phonetically, in many instances, but Tel Aviv, the word Tel Aviv is actually spelled with two of the letter beta or beth, the B, right? It's actually spelled with B's, not with the vav, which in ancient Hebrew may be represented by a B, right? By a V, I mean, by a vav. A vav, a V would be represented by a vav. It could be a V or it could be a W in transliterations. But the Beth is the letter B. And that should never be represented by a V, in my opinion. But in some European languages, the V and the B were interchangeable. And the V and the F were sometimes interchangeable. So that V sound, I mean, even Wikipedia claims that it's Tel Aviv, but they primarily spell it as Tel Aviv. I would not equate this with Tel Aviv in Hebrew. But of course, we're not talking about Hebrew when we think about modern Tel Aviv. We're really talking about Yiddish, right? So I see a difference in the ancient form of the word from the modern Tel Aviv. But in the modern use of that B, as it's translated into other languages, it's Tel Aviv. It's Tel Aviv, right? And that's a modern phenomenon, but I don't believe it's a Hebrew phenomenon.
So if we look at a map and we look at Tel Aviv, is that where Ezekiel was going to?
Oh, no, this is definitely a different place. This is in Babylonia by the river Kabar. Then I came to them in captivity at Tel Aviv that dwelt by the river of Kabar. And evidently this Tel Aviv means, Tel is always a hill. Right? A tel in Hebrew or in Arabic is always a hill. And this means hill of the spring. Or hill of the flood, if you will. a spring or a river, flood is just another word for spring or river in many cases where it's used, where it appears. And that's an archaic English usage, right? It's not to be confused with the flood of Noah. Every river is basically a flood. It's a runoff of rainwater, right?
Right.
So in archaic English, a flood could often refer to a river. And it even does in the King James Version, where in Joshua, I think it's chapter 24, chapter 25. Joshua chapter 24, he refers to the other side of the flood in old time in the King James Version. That's actually a reference to the other side of the Euphrates River, right? Where Abraham had come from Haran, is on the other side of the Euphrates River from Palestine. So the King James translated that other side of the flood. It should have more properly been other side of the river.
Thanks, Bill.
So hill of the flood is the definition of Tel Aviv often, but it should mean hill of the river or hill of the spring. It was just a hill by Kabar, which is a river, or sometimes it's considered a canal, which is why the Jews would call it a ditch. But it was probably a spring that was dug into a canal, if you want my opinion. I mean, if you want a canal, if you want to make a room for shipping, how much better is it to follow a natural river?
Right, right. Yeah, that would make sense.
So you just dig out a spring in it until it becomes big enough for your shipping, right? A creek or a whatever, stream.
This verse, when Ezekiel arrives there and he's like, I remain there astonished among them 7 days. I just picture him in my head just sitting there like, what the hell just happened?
I mean that the visions must have made some impression on him.
It reminds me of when Philip is immersing the Ethiopian eunuch, and it sort of seems to imply he's teleported.
Yeah, I understand that. It really does. He was taken in the spirit. It doesn't necessarily mean that he was teleported, but it does seem to make that implication.
If he was, I bet he was also astonished for 7 days.
Yeah, but I wouldn't see it as a necessary interpretation of the words taken in the spirit.
Right.
I kind of see it that perhaps, of course, at the instigation or with the influence of the spirit, yet you suddenly could walk to Florida, right? Yet you could,
right,
you
yeah.
walk Florida, and it took 3.5 months, and you said, I was taken in the spirit to Florida.
Sort of like being compelled to do something.
Right. But then again, I wouldn't blame God for all my compulsions.
That's also true.
Okay, I guess we could read the final portion of this verse. Of this chapter is only a few more verses.
Yep. Then I arose and went forth into the plain, and behold, the glory of Yahweh stood there, as the glory which I saw by the river Kabar, and I fell on my face. Then the Spirit entered into me, and set me upon my feet, and spake with me, and said unto me, Go, shut thyself within thine house. But thou, O son of man, behold, they shall put bands upon thee, and shall bind thee with them, and thou shalt not go out among them. And I will make thy tongue cleave to the roof of thy mouth, that thou shalt be dumb, and shalt not be to them a reprover. For they are a rebellious house. But when I speak with thee, I will open thy mouth, and thou shalt say unto them, Thus saith Yahweh God, He that heareth, let him hear, and he that forbeareth, let him forbear, for they are a rebellious house.
Well, like I said, the warnings to keep the law and not to do evil are pretty strong, and the prophet's going to tell them that doing evil, Yahweh will forget all of your good works, and that's like a pretty strong admonition that you better walk the line. I don't make a Christian doctrine out of that, because Christ forgives our sin, otherwise what's his purpose? But it was a stern warning to these people at this time. This is to the 10,000 in Babylon. And for the most part, I believe that the righteous who return later on are from among these 10,000, from the descendants of these 10,000. That basically everybody left behind in Jerusalem, just about everybody, is just going to suffer punishment or end up being cursed. To be the good figs that are handed over to the wicked figs for their punishment. In Jeremiah chapter 24, I believe that is, or is it 19? Jeremiah chapter 24. The naughty figs that couldn't even be eaten. And it's Zedekiah, the king of Judah, and his princes, and the residue of Jerusalem. Zedekiah is the king that replaced Jeconiah, and he's talking about that replaced Jehoiakim, and it's not Jehoiachin's princes that were taken into captivity he's talking about in Jeremiah chapter 24. It's the princes that Zedekiah will later have, and they're just going to be handed over to the residue that remains in this land. And the Judahites that fled to Egypt would all be handed over to the evil figs which could not be eaten in Jeremiah chapter 24. So these 10,000, that these are actually not an object of that prophecy in Jeremiah. So these 10,000, they're going to be preserved for the better, where the residue or those who remained behind, they're going to be handed over to the evil figs, according to Jeremiah chapter 24. But these 10,000 that were taken to Babylon have escaped that fate.
Are they putting bands on Ezekiel because they wish to make him like a slave or a servant?
I'm sorry, which verse is that?
25.
Oh. No, I think if they put bans upon Ezekiel, it's because they must be the people that Ezekiel is about to address. And when he gives them this message, that they're going to bind them.
Oh, okay, so it's symbolic.
Yes. Well, the people are going to bind Ezekiel when they hear this.
Gotcha. We see again that Yahweh wants Ezekiel to stand at his feet in the verse right before that.
Right. Right, because our God himself is, and he knows his true power, and he's a humble God. I mean, he came as Christ to die, right? To live as a humble man and to die. I mean, that's the ultimate example of God's humility, for God to be humble is an awesome thing in itself, right?
It's incredible.
But if he's truly God, he knows his own power. He doesn't have to be a show-off or overbearing. And he created you to stand on your feet. So evidently, he wants us to stand on our feet. I mean, It's what would you say to your son? If your son acts like a bitch and crouched down and tried to hide himself from you, you'd just say, stand the fuck up. Stand up. What are you doing? Stand up and come over here.
No, this is a really great retort for all those assholes who, and mostly atheists and Jews, who try to picture God as some guy in the sky who's just screaming, worship me all day.
Yeah, right. It's more like, stand up, come over here, and fulfill the purpose for which you were created.
Yeah, I made you.
I created a man. I didn't create a bitch. Be a man.
Exactly. Like, I made you. I made you for a reason. These are the rules of your existence in this world. Follow them and just be what I made you to be.
Well, I remember talking to my sons like that when I admonished them. I'd say, stand up and get the hell over here now.
Right.
My father probably said the same thing to me. That's how I learned it, right?
Well, yeah, you don't want to raise a bitch.
Right.
I think this was my favorite part of the Bible study tonight. I think this is a really amazing insight into the character of God.
Well, it's right there in black and white.
Yeah.
What are you doing on your knees? Get up and come over here. Stand up like a man.
I see it a lot in the New Testament, but it's nice to see some good Old Testament references to it too.
Yeah. But in the meantime, they're screwed if they sin, because all their righteousness is going to be blotted out. I mean, that doesn't cost them that their eternal life or anything, but that's that they're going to be punished in this world for their sin. They're not going to get away with it. They'll be forgiven.
Oh, yeah.
That's basically what they're being told. And forgiveness is first a non-punishing for sin or injury. That's what forgiveness is. It's a remission of punishment.
And that's another hallmark of a good father, disciplining your children.
Yes. I must admit that I haven't read Ezekiel in probably many years, probably since I read the Septuagint. That's been at least 15 years.
I've only read it once.
Yeah, I've read it through at least two or three times from cover to cover, but once in the King James Version, once in the Septuagint. I don't remember if I read it again, but I imagine in prison I would pick up the book and just read a book, and I probably did read it more than once.
For me, I feel it lulls a bit in like chapter 20 to chapter 29, and then all the 30s are really interesting. All the chapter 30s are really good.
Ezekiel 34, chapter 2. Maybe this is why I can't remember it.
I often go back to books too and just read them independently, and I do that a lot with the prophets, and then I do it even more with the New Testament. But I can never motivate myself to go back. It's like, hey, I'm going to read Second Chronicles again. I find it like laborious.
Yeah, they are. Those books are laborious. They're so concise. There's so much that's not there. And
yeah, like. Usually when I'm going back to read a prophet again, like I find it educational, but also like I find it fun. But if I'm reading Second Chronicles again or something, I'm just like, oh boy. I'm sure once my historical understanding improves, I'll find it more interesting.
Yeah, you really need that historical knowledge to understand those books.
Exactly. I'm very intermediate when it comes to that for now.
Yeah, same.
Well, none of us is going to understand all of ancient history perfectly. It's just not going to happen. It's far too vast a topic. And
well, that's why it's good there's so many of us, because some will be a nose and another will be an ear and another will be an elbow, as Paul would put it.
I realized right away when I found CI that I had to learn history a lot better in order to understand if it was true or not and study that. So I did focus a lot on ancient history, and sometimes I'm even disappointed with my recall of that, but that's just the way life is, right? Now it's 25 years since I read Herodotus, or 23 years at least. I think it was 99. And I read Josephus and Tacitus in 98, and everything kind of gets fuzzy after a while. I wish I had the time to go back and read them again. And they're just scratching the surface.
I've started reading those books, and it's like really an exercise for your brain. You have to read it slowly, because if you're just reading it at a fast pace, you won't soak in everything.